the least important things. And I think that's what Dr. Swenson wants to remind us of.
Hmm. Well, he is a very popular guest. And in case you missed that interview from Jim's basement, Dr. Swenson is a trained medical physician. He served for 27 years in both private practice and as an instructor with the University of Wisconsin. And he left that field when he felt God was leading him to be what he calls a watchman on the wall, someone who interprets the signs of the times. And he spent much of his life studying faith and health and culture, and he's an author. His latest book is called In Search of Balance, Keys to a Stable Life. And with that, here's Dr. Richard Swenson at a Focus on the Family event.
There was a six-year-old boy on a Saturday. He was home and was getting into a lot of mischief, and his mother was tiring of him. And finally, he did the one thing that kind of was the straw that broke the camel's back. And the mother sort of set her chin and she headed down the hall chasing him. And of course, he knew what that look was. And so he expertly dodged down the hall, turned into his bedroom, crawled underneath his bed. And the mom said, well, I'll just leave him there. It's a good place for him. I don't have to deal with him now. I'll wait till Dad comes home. He's out doing some errands. When he comes home, he can manage this problem. So Dad comes home about an hour later and mother tells Dad what the kid was doing. Dad goes down the hall, goes in the bedroom, gets on his hands and knees and started crawling underneath the bed. And the six-year-old said, hi, Dad, is she after you too? I always kind of start with signs of the times. A mother, a busy mother, invented a five-day diaper. She says, I don't have time anymore to change the diaper. The babies really don't care. We do it because we don't like it. And so she has this diaper that goes around the neck. You change it once every 5 days. Stays busy mothers 9 hours a week. Here's another sign of the times, an Amish home. You know, Amish people are very good at making furniture and quilts and clothing and so on. And they usually sell them in stores. Now, some homes have opened the home for selling the Amish goods. And now there's one house, one Amish home that takes Visa. That's a sign of the times. Here's another one. We're kind of getting to this. Newsweek magazine. I don't know if you saw this a couple of years back. Harvard University president on the cover here, he hit the wall, had to take an emergency sabbatical, checked himself into the hospital. They said, exhausted. They said, there's some kind of epidemic hitting people in America today. It's causing everybody to talk how overcommitted and exhausted and tired they are and how they just want to sort of check into a jail or lay in bed for a week. They say, compared to the exhaustion of the past and the tiredness of the past, you see, in the past what you did is you took a book and you went to the beach and 1 week in August, and you just vegetated for a while. One of those old moldy cabins, you know, and you sat on the pier for a while, and you read the book. You're fine. You're fine for another year. They say compared to that kind of therapy, it doesn't work anymore because as soon as people come back and step on the treadmill, they're instantly tired again. As a matter of fact, there's a recent study out of Israel. They took people who were burned out. They measured all the burnout parameters. They gave them a two-week vacation. The two-week vacation successfully decompressed the burnout parameters. As soon as they came back and stepped on a day-to-day treadmill, after 3 weeks, they're right back to baseline burnout again. The story behind that is you can't store up all your needs for once a year in the summer. You're not going to make it that far. We have to learn the secret of renewal in an ongoing, paced sort of way. They quote one mother of four in this article from LaGrange, Illinois. She says, I'm so tired, my idea of a vacation is a trip to the dentist. I just can't wait to sit in that chair and relax. I've had dentists come up and tell me. I have people falling asleep in the chair during a root canal. That's abnormal, folks. That is not normal. It's a sign of the times. One person says, my life is a blender and somebody's taking the lid off of it. That stuff on the wall is not a mirage. We're like field mice on amphetamines at harvest time. Max Lucado says, we're the only nation in the world with a mountain named Rushmore. Mary Pfeiffer is a best-selling author. She says that if we let culture just happen to us, we'll all end up exhausted, addicted, broke, with a house full of junk in no time. That's about it. We close the book and go home. I mean, that's the diagnosis right there. We got to figure out what to do. One guy came up to me and says, I think I'm too busy. I said, why is that? He said, my accrued vacation time exceeds my actuarial life expectancy. It was predicted in 1967 that by 1985, people would be working 22 hours a week for a Senate subcommittee. Nobody laughed. Everybody nodded and took notes. Every futurist predicted the same thing. The work week was going to shorten because productivity was going to increase. Wages are tied to productivity. As wages went up, people would be working less and less. So all the futurists, virtually 100% of the futurists in the mid-60s thought that by now, you'd have one wage earner per family working 20 hours a week. You could buy the house, pay for health care, put your kids through college, save for retirement, put braces on your kids' teeth, marry off your daughters, I mean, whatever it takes, one wage earner, 20 hours a week. The reality of the new millennium is this. The average husband-wife unit is putting in 90 hours a week, not 20. 90, not 20. Men are working about 48.8 hours a week, women 41.7 hours a week. Now those gals at 41.7 hours a week, if you think you're tired, you are. Because when you get home, I mean that's 41.7 hours outside the home. When you get home, you put in the total and you add it up. It's 65 to 85 hours per week for women. Men at 48.8 hours and 0.2 hours of domestic duty, so that's up to 49. That's stressful. One thing I learned at a national security seminar, I was there for a week, I got a notebook, and one of the lines in the notebook, and this is true, statistical fact, universally true, and no country has violated this principle, that never in the history of the world has a man been shot while doing the dishes. Never happened. So if you're really scared, just stand in front of the sink. So what was predicted was boredom. What we have is exhaustion. As a good physician, I ask questions. How did that happen? You have to analyze. You have to figure out what went wrong because the original predictions were reasonable predictions, and yet it didn't happen exactly that way. Now, for those who think it's a figment of our imagination, let me give you a couple statistics. 30 million American men describe their lives as being stressed out. I don't know what the figure is for women, but if those guys are married, it's at least 30 million women. 36% of Americans describe themselves as being rushed all the time. Not part of the time, all the time. More than one-third of Americans. We're interrupted 202 times a day. We spend 8 months of our lives opening junk mail. We spend 1 year of our lives searching through the clutter on our desk looking for misplaced objects. You know how far the average misplaced object travels? 10 inches. We spend 2 years of our lives trying to call people who aren't in or whose line is busy. The average American gets 2.5 hours less sleep than 100 years ago. Something was invented about 100 years ago that invaded the night. It was light bulb and electricity. And in 1850, people got 9.5 hours of sleep a night. In 1910, it was 9 hours a night. In 1950, it was 8 hours a night. In 1990, it was 7 hours a night. It's still going down. 50 to 70 million Americans have sleep disorder problems. If half of you fall asleep here, it's because you don't sleep at night. 27% of Americans fell asleep while driving last year. 27% of Americans. Interesting. Is this a figment of our imagination? Some more evidence. Center for Disease Control says migraine headaches are up 60% in the last decade. I get migraines. Yeah, mine are up 60% in the last decade. It's about right. Well, I could give you even some more, but I think I've made my case. Something is going on. What about in the church? Jennifer Glass, University of Iowa, she says it takes 20 to 30 phone calls in the average church to get the same number of volunteers it used to take 2 to 3 phone calls to get. Archibald Hart reported about a survey on prayer. He says 85% of Christians admit that they do all of their praying or most of their praying on the run. Sounds about right? There's something going on in our society that's causing people to be wheezing and worn out, overloaded, overwhelmed, exhausted, and we need to judge it because it's the enemy of our relationships. It's the enemy of the spiritual life. It's toxic to the things of the kingdom. You dip the ladle into the well, you pull the ladle up, there's got to be something in the ladle. And if your well is dry, we need to find ways to restore some energy, what I call some margin. Now, why is this happening on our generational shift? Why is this happening right now? It's largely because of progress. You need to understand me when I talk about that. I am not an enemy of progress. I'm not criticizing it. I think it's normative biblical activity. I think it's part of the Genesis creation mandate for us to go out there and work on the world. Progress, we don't usually try to think what is progress anyway and how does progress work. We just sort of have faith in this something called progress that, you know, is going to make life better. But it's helpful to understand our marginlessness and our overload if we understand what progress is. Progress works by differentiation. Okay, that's probably the biggest highfalutin word I'll use. If you go cut down a tree and bring it up here on a platform and say, differentiate the tree, progress will make fruit bowls and tables and baseball bats and wooden forks out of the tree. But as a result of that, it always leads to more. As a matter of fact, more and more of everything faster and faster. Progress always leads to more and more of everything faster and faster. It cannot go in the opposite direction. It will always lead to more, often at exponential rates. There's a very interesting clinical significance about this, in that when progress gives us more and more of everything faster and faster, axiomatically, it's going to lead to increasing stress. Axiomatically. That follows 100%. It'll lead to increasing stress, change, complexity, speed, and overload. I'm going to take those one at a time. Stress. What is stress anyway? I mean, it's kind of a rhetorical question here because I don't want to start a debate, but stress is stress a bad thing? If I could give you a life with no stress, would you take that? Would you want that? If you did, you literally would die. You would die. If we just park you here in a chair and have you stare at the wall and come check your pulse in 6 months, you won't have a pulse. I mean, you'll be a skeleton by that time. You'd be dead. You don't want no stress at all. We have to have a certain amount of stress in our life to stay alive. What about low stress? Not no stress, but low stress. How about that? That sounds tempting, doesn't it? The studies have been done. We put people in high stress for a month and low stress for a month. Guess which people prefer? High stress. You're exactly right. Now, you'd like to make that decision for yourself, probably, because we just don't remember that low-stress kids have a name for the low-stress condition. Boring. Boring. It's been 10 years since you've been bored, so you don't remember. You don't like it either. But if you went there, you wouldn't like it. Now, to say that we don't want no stress, we don't want low stress, does not exalt a hyper-stress environment. It's kind of a curve that goes like this. When you get to the top of that curve and you push beyond that, then things start to break. Reliably, bad things start to happen to your emotions, to your physical energy, to your productivity. Productivity starts coming down on the backside. Creativity, longevity, morale in the workplace, all those things are affected if stress gets pushed too far. So the job of a manager in a workplace is to keep people toward the top there where stress is good, where it feels good, where you're being productive and you're getting a lot done, and you go home at the end of the day and you pat yourself on the back. But progress keeps pushing that curve over further and further. I believe that God created the stress mechanism. It's a value-neutral thing inside of it. It's really a term about physiology. When any change comes into my life, then I have to adapt to the change. If you look at a rigorous medical definition of stress, that adaptation mechanism is stress. That equals the same thing. It's value-neutral. So if somebody gives me a check from Publishers Clearing House Sweepstakes for $10 million, I have to adapt to that. If a tiger chases me around the room, I have to adapt. It doesn't make any difference. It's good, bad, whatever it is, you have to adapt. We're very adaptable. God made us that way. But there is a point at which you can overwhelm the adaptational mechanism and cause illness. Stress. The second thing is change. There's been more change. Progress always leads to stress. It always leads to change. There's been more change from 1900 to the present than in all recorded history prior to 1900. And it's not slowing down. The third thing is complexity. Some things in life are simple and some are complex, and most are kind of in a bell-shaped curve in between. But progress moves that curve toward complexity all the time. Any two-bit engineer can make something more complicated. That's going with the flow. It's very easy. It takes a genius, dedicated effort to make something simple. I have a physics degree and I don't know how to set my watch. The average American has to learn how to operate 20,000 pieces of technology in their lifetime. 3/4 of them are designed to infuriate.
You are listening to Focus on the Family, and that's Dr. Richard Swenson, author of the best-selling book, Margin. And he has more to share. Let me just mention, though, that you can find this entire program and details about Dr. Swenson's book, In Search of Balance, at focusonthefamily.com/radio, or in Canada, focusonthefamily.ca. Well, here's more now from Dr. Swenson on Focus on the Family.
I have a physics degree. I don't know how to set the clock in my car radio. We got a new copy machine at our clinic, and it took me 6 months to figure out how to use a copy machine. So complexity. You know, very seldom, A.W. Tozer wrote many decades ago that very seldom do we see the simplicity, the true simplicity of the gospel message even in our churches today. Very simple message. God basically saying to us, I love you. Won't you let me rescue you? It's a very simple thing. Don't complexify it. Speed, that's the fourth thing. Okay, progress axiomatically increases stress, change, complexity, and speed. Don't you have a feeling that the treadmill is going faster every year, that there's an automatically advancing speed rheostat somewhere, and you find a guy, I just want to deck him, is what I want to do. But every year, the world seems to be spinning faster. But my question in the midst of that, is there a speed limit to life? I mean, is there a point at which we're going at a certain speed, and all of a sudden things don't work anymore? I mean, we crash, or, you know, God gives us a speeding ticket or something. I mean, out there in the interstate, it's probably 65, maybe, so let's say 65. Why don't they just up it, you know, like 5 miles an hour every year? And then in 15 years, you can get to San Diego in 12 minutes. Why don't they do that? There's a reason why they don't do that. Because if you go past a certain speed, then bad things happen. In the same way, what happens to our life when we go faster and faster and faster? I know I talk fast. You want to tell me, well, slow down then, okay, if you're condemning speed. But speed, think about the toxicity of speed some. You know, I don't know exactly what the speed limit is. I know that there's a point at which I'm going too fast because dysfunction just starts to happen with my attitude. I get upset at people. I start perspiring. My stomach starts burning or something. And you just don't want anybody to be around you. There are times where you have to go fast. It's true. But James Thurber says, man is flying too fast for a world that is round. Soon he will catch up with himself in a great rear-end collision. Speed. There's more to life than increasing its speed. H.B. London was interviewing Henry Blackaby, who wrote Experiencing God, and he said, how did you get all this stuff done? I just admire you so much. You've accomplished so much for the kingdom. You're just a model for all of us of godliness. And Blackaby said, well, he said, I spent my whole life hurrying God. I was running around doing all this stuff, and God had to fit into it all. And then one day God said to me, Henry, you're not going to hurry me anymore. You are going to have to fit into my schedule. And Blackaby says it changed everything. The Bible doesn't say anything about Jesus running. The Bible doesn't say anything about Jesus running. What was ministry for Jesus? It's the person standing in front of him. The person standing in front of me is an obstacle. I'm trying to get over, under, round, or through this thing to stand in front of me because I got to get somewhere down the road. But for Jesus, that was ministry. He was never in a hurry. He was never surprised. He came to do two things, to love the person standing in front of him and go to Jerusalem to die. And nobody could distract him from what he came to do. Speed, be careful about it. And then overload. We're finishing up with the analysis and diagnosis here. We will get to the therapeutics. I want to explain about overload because overload is the opposite of margin. If you have a little space between your load and your limits, then you have some margin in your life. If you're past the threshold of human limits and you're overloaded, then you're negative margin status. If there's a threshold here and say this is 100%, this is 95%, okay, as I get to 97, 99, 101, how do I know I just crossed that line? Isn't that an important question? I mean, if your car is going down the interstate and the engine's overheating, you have a red light that comes on and steam starts to come on. I mean, there's indicators that something's going wrong and you pull off. Or if your electrical system is discharging, the needle will kind of tell you that. But we don't have a red light blinking on the end of our nose at 95% and then sirens that go off at 100%. I wish God built that equipment in because then a lot of us would figure this whole thing out. So we have to figure out when we cross over that threshold of human limits, how do we know that it just happened? For a lot of us, I think the best clue is to listen to our bodies talk to us. There's certain symptom complex that will develop. For some people, they develop apathy, withdrawal, depression, work dread. You ever been there? Can't get out of bed. Just cannot face it. For some people, that's very common. For other people, it's irritability. I think that's one of my hallmark symptoms, irritability and migraine headaches. When I'm irritable and I get nonstop migraines, I know something's wrong. My body's talking to me and God's talking to me through my body and says, back off on the throttle a little bit. Sleep a little more. Rest. Find that green pastures and still waters where I restore your soul. God says, I can run the universe. I don't need your help. I mean, just rest for a while, because for other people, it's moral failure. That's how they know when they get across the line. For other people, it's mistakes. I had a CPA tell me, that's my indicator. When I start making too many mistakes, I know I'm overloaded. It's not good if you're a CPA at tax time and make mistakes. That's just not a good thing. So figure out what your symptoms are. How about physical symptoms? Some people, their stomach starts burning. Some people develop a twitch. I'll save a whole bunch of money here for you people. You know that little twitch that comes in your eye like that every once in a while? It's always nerves. I mean, you don't have Lou Gehrig's disease. You don't have multiple sclerosis. You don't have to go to your doctor. It's nerves. There's probably 15 people here twitching right now. And you know, you think that people can see it from 3 blocks away. They can't. I mean, it seems like your whole half of your face is going like that. It's nerves. God gave us a simple little indicator. Some people just get rashes or something like that, or palpitations, or there's all kinds of different symptoms. I was speaking before some members of Congress once. And one person said, what are the symptoms of stress? And I kind of gave those ones that I just mentioned to you, physical ones, emotional ones, behavioral ones, about 15 of them. There was a congressperson sitting right next to me here and says, what does it mean if you have all of those? And everybody sort of laughed, but it was a nervous laughter. I think everybody in the room had all of them. So overload. We need to understand, you know, you also have to have a functioning theology and psychology of human limits. Do we have limits? I mean, are they real? Let's back it up and start at the beginning. Do we have limits? We do. Where did they come from? As far as I can tell, it's from three sources. Either it's a cosmic fluke, or they came at the fall, or God built them in. And I think the answer is God built them in. God didn't want competition with the job being God. He's infinite, I'm not. He put some limits in me to convince me that I'm not him. God is the creator, I'm the creature. So if God designed the limits, put them in, and you can tell that right away with a 24-hour day. I mean, you can't budge that. No matter how much you beg God, he slapped the governor on the whole system in terms of what we can do, 24-hour day. If God is the author of our limits, and he designed them and he put them in there, it's probably okay with him that I have them. He probably thinks it's a little silly of us to ignore the reality of human limits, which are very, I mean, a kindergarten kid could understand about that. You can't swim the Pacific Ocean. As a matter of fact, I think it probably insults his creation wisdom when we pretend we don't have limits. You see, the fact that I have limits is not a threat to God. Let me say that again. The fact that I have limits is not a threat to God. God does his best work in the face of human limits, human weakness, brokenness, emptiness. That's where he moves in, takes over, and massive things happen. The Bible doesn't say anything about Jesus running. The Bible doesn't say anything about Jesus running. What was ministry for Jesus? It's the person standing in front of him. The person standing in front of me is an obstacle. I'm trying to get over, under, round, or through this thing to stand in front of me because I got to get somewhere down the road. But for Jesus, that was ministry.
Oh, I don't know about you, but that's a really convicting thought for me. And I get busy. I see other folks as obstacles rather than opportunities for ministry. And on today's Focus on the Family with Jim Daly, we'll hear more from that man there, Dr. Richard Swenson, about how to slow down and make time for those divine appointments in our lives.
John, that's really the issue. It's not just that stress and overscheduling are bad for our health. The issue is how it impacts our relationships and our ability to focus on the most important things in life, which is sharing the good news of the Lord Jesus Christ. And, you know, it's tough to do that when you're cutting someone off on the freeway.
Well, I wouldn't know, Jim, but...
Have you ever cut anybody off on the freeway?
No.
Well, you must be a great driver.
I'm joking. Of course I do.
So I'm thrilled to share part two of the message Dr. Swenson has for us today. And in case you missed part one, you can go to the website. John, you'll give details of that at the end of the program just to download that message. But Dr. Swenson talked about how our fast-paced culture leads to increasing stress, change, complexity, speed, and overloaded lives in general, John. And today we're going to hear him offer some practical solutions and how we can make some much-needed changes in our lives.
This is an appropriate message for most of us, and Dr. Swenson really knows his stuff. His background is as a former medical doctor. And he's always been fascinated about how faith and health and culture kind of work together. And you'll hear a passion in his voice for this subject as we get going. Now, he's the author of the best-selling book Margin, and his latest is called In Search of Balance. Here's Dr. Richard Swenson on today's Focus on the Family.
Let me role play a little bit. Here's 80%, and there's 100%, and there's 120%. And you're at 80% here. And say you're a physician, and your partner comes up to you and says, could you take my call this weekend? I'm supposed to, my sister's got cancer surgery. It's over in Wyoming there, and it's a family crisis, and I've got to go. Could you take my call for me? And you say, sure. Yeah, I got some space in my life, and I like my work. I like my patients. I can earn a little extra money. I like you. I hope everything's okay with your sister. You'll pay me back sometime by taking a call from me. Sure, I'll help you out. That'll be fine. And then they call from church, and they say, you know, the fourth grade teacher broke a leg and is out for 3 months. Could you teach the fourth grade Sunday school class just for 3 months? And you say, that'd be great. Thanks for asking me. That'd be great. You know, I love those kids. That's wonderful. And I need to get in the Bible and study some of those stories. Thanks for asking me. Your spouse, if you haven't been married, your spouse says, how about taking the neighbors out to dinner? You know, they've lived there, I think, 2 or 3 years. I don't even know what they look like. I think we ought to, you know, have them out to dinner or go for a movie or something. You say, let's do it Friday night. Great idea. You get to 100% here, and you're straddling that 100% line, and your coworker comes to you and says, I got a family crisis. I need somebody to take my call. Could you take my call for me? And you say, well, you know, I don't know. You know, I'd really like to. I just, we're so maxed out at home. You should see our calendar. I mean, it's just insane. My family would annihilate me if I took something. I'll have to, you know, have a family meeting at home. I'll let you know tomorrow. I hope I can. I'm not sure. I'll tell you what. I'll do it. I don't know how I'll do it. Just this once, I'll do it. And then you come away from that and say, what happened to me? I always wanted to help people before. This person needs my help, and I don't even care. I don't care about this person anymore. What's going on in my life? And so then they call from Sunday school, and they say, could you teach the fourth grade class? We got, you know, for 3 months. You say, you know, I'd love to do that. I just can't right now. My plate's full right now. I can't do it right now, but I'm glad you called me. Put me on the list down the road when life gets better, and maybe I can do it then, but not right now. And then your spouse says, how about taking the neighbors out to dinner? You say, that's a great idea, but we can't do it this week. I mean, you know what our worst calendar's like. We'll consider that and do it as soon as something opens up. Then you get to 120% here, and your coworker comes to you and says, can you take my call for me this weekend? I'm supposed to be, and you say, stop. I quit. I'm sick and tired. Everybody dumping their problems on my desk, last minute, expecting me to bail them out. It's happening every day, every week, every month, every year. So as long as I've worked here, where's the door? I'm out of here. Then they call from the fourth grade Sunday school class, and they say, could you teach the fourth grade? You say, I hate kids. And you're an idiot. Whatever makes you think I want to do that. And then your spouse says, how about taking the neighbors out to dinner on Friday night? And you say, I got a better idea. I'm coming home, 5 o'clock. I'm going to go in the door, turn around, close the door. I'm going to lock the door. I'm going to deadbolt the door. I'm pulling all the curtains. I'm turning off all the lights. I'm pushing the refrigerator and the television next to bed. I'm not getting up till Monday morning. Now, sometimes I think I've kind of over-embellished this 120% thing, and people say, no, you just don't know my life. In which of those three stations were you a better advertisement for the things of God? In which of those three stations or those three scenarios did you better fulfill the commandments that Jesus asked of you to interrupt your life, to love people, to carry others' burdens, to walk the second mile? There is a lot at stake here. This is not just pop psychology. This is practical, street-level theology about being able to do what God is asking us to do on a regular basis, loving people and carrying their burdens. Well, margin is what I'm suggesting. We need a little space between our Lord and our limits. People used to have a little margin. I'm not exalting the past. I don't want to go back there, but the people in the 30s and the 20s and the 10s, they slept full nights. They took weekends off. They had community structure. They had extended families. They ate meals together. And so life was hard. Life was destitute. Life was tragic. There were lots of problems. I don't want to go back there, but people did have a little bit of the sense of what I'm talking about, what we need, that has been taken away from us by these remarkable situations with progress. I look at margin in four different areas, emotional energy, physical energy, time, and finances. Let me just cover as much of that as I can. Between my two books, Margin and The Overload Syndrome, there's like 250 RXs, prescriptions. So, you know, we'll get through 20 or 30 maybe. Let's look at margin and time first. I think the most important is margin and emotional energy, but for a lot of people, it's margin and time. One of the first things to gain some margin and time is to expect the unexpected. This isn't a perfect world. Planes cancel. Accidents happen on the interstate. People sprain their ankle. And if you have your day packed, you know, with appointments, boom, 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 boom. At the end of the day, if everything went fine, then you pat yourself on the back because you're maximally effective. But what happens if something falls apart between, you know, like the third and fourth thing that you had planned? You know, your car runs out of gas and you can't find your wallet, or you get in a migraine, or there's a snowstorm, or, you know, the other person doesn't show up on time. What happens to the rest of your day? It all cascades out of control. The whole thing unravels, doesn't it? And then you get mad at everybody. Expect the unexpected. They have a brilliant saying in Ecuador. It goes like this: everything takes longer than it does. Remember that. The second thing is to learn to say no. This is a hard one, okay? But out of the 250 RXs, I probably would say that five of them are of fundamental importance. That if you won't learn those five, it has to do with boundaries and simplicity and so on. Learning to say no is crucial, because if you've seen the flow of progress, 15 years ago we had like 10 things to choose from to do today. Not today, but, you know, next Tuesday or something like that. That's 15 years ago. Now we have like 38 things to choose from. Because progress gives more and more of everything faster and faster. And if you wait 10 years and you don't do anything about it, you're going to have 62 things. That's the flow. It's axiomatic. It's automatic. It happens to everybody in American culture. And so you've seen this escalation of number of things that you can choose to be involved in. But the thing that didn't change is the 24-hour day. So you have more things on your plate to choose from, but no more time to do those things. So that just means you have to say yes to some things and no to other things. When you look at just the logic of it, I mean, that's really easy to perceive, to understand, isn't it? I mean, that's really kindergarten mathematics in some senses. But it is extraordinarily hard to say no, isn't it? You feel guilty and you don't want to disappoint other people, and you want to be involved in things, and you don't want to disappoint God, because Jesus did all that for us. And so, you know, we should do what we can for God. But God didn't design us to be all things to all people all the time all by ourselves. He did not. I mean, that's something that when we get it wrong and try to do that, somebody said my sister's going to die of terminal sincerity. It's about right. I mean, she's a sweet person, but, you know, she's not God. She's a wonderful person. If the whole world was my sister, the world would be fine. We'd solve all our problems instantly. So learn how to say no. That just means we have to have a priority structure and a value system that can inform what we say yes to and what we say no to. And you don't get that value structure from the world. Listen to that very carefully, because most of our marching orders come from the world and the world system. It's easy to say no to bad things. It's easy to say no to a flexible sigmoidoscopy. Or like a root canal or an IRS audit or something like that. You know, that's a no-brainer. But it's hard to say no to fun, enjoyable things we always wanted to do. But you only have 24 hours a day. And so you have to prioritize. Learn how to say no. Howard Hendricks says every pastor should say no at least once a day. Just to keep in practice, you know. One church I went to said, we teach our people that no is a holy word. If you're going to do what God wants you to do, you're going to have to say no to some things that the world is trying to shove in front of you. Let me talk about simplicity and contentment a little bit. This is a big theme in all of my writing, as a matter of fact, because everything I own owns me. Everything I own, I have to take care of. I have to dust it, maintain it, and paint it, and use it, and build space in my house to put it, and then I have to work to pay it off. And I see too much, and I want too much, and I buy too much, and then I have too much debt, and then I'm working too hard to pay off the debt, and pretty soon all my relationships have vaporized. Another one, separate time from technology. Let's look at some of these issues related to time-saving technology. If you want a little bit more discretionary time in your life, you got to discern and judge the time-saving technology. The best thing to remember about time-saving technology is it doesn't. It compresses, consumes, and devours time. All the countries with the most time-saving technologies are the most stressed-out countries. They're the most harried and hurried countries. Let's look at them one at a time. That doesn't mean we ought to throw them all away, but you have to discern when to use them, when not. How about I like email. I do not like telephones. When I'm home by myself, I usually don't answer the telephone, and we don't have an answer machine on a residential line. It just rings, and I sit there and look at it. I don't feel guilty at all. I'm sorry if it's you, but But I like email because, you see, a telephone ringing is a drill in the air. You have to do it, you know, right then, and it's tyrannizing. But email, I can do it whenever I want to. And I can do it with two sentences, and I can do it 3 o'clock in the morning. I can do it 3 days from now or 2 weeks from now. How about cell phones? 50 million in the United States. Cell phones can be wonderful. You live in North Dakota and you're driving in a snowstorm. It's a great idea to have a cell phone in the car. One of the young doctors that I taught, she put up her hand. She said, I got a cell phone for Mother's Day. It's been wonderful. Now I can take my daughter for a stroller ride around the park when I'm on call, or I can go pick up something at the grocery store. It's been wonderful. It's freed me. It's helped me tremendously. And that's true. Let me talk about the downside a little bit. My secretary helped me with my second book. Her father died last May. The pastor was at the bedside praying a few days before the death. In the middle of the prayer, the pastor's cell phone went off. He stopped the prayer and answered the cell phone. Now, he apologized, but he said, well, it just would have kept ringing. That wasn't good either. My mother sent me an article about a gal in Iowa. She was buying bagels on Saturday morning, and she got up to the front of the line. There were 26 people behind her. She couldn't make up her mind what bagels to get, so she got her cell phone out of her purse and called all 8 of her kids. Well, Susie, what kind do you want? Well, put Jimmy on the phone, would you? Well, Jimmy, would you put Ralph on the phone? I was sitting trying to have a continental breakfast in San Francisco a couple months ago, and there were 3 of us sitting in this room. And the one guy was really loud. He was just right. I mean, he was 2 feet away from me. You know, I mean, there's just 3 of us here, but he sat right there. He's talking to his boss, and fine, okay, you know, I'm eating my bagel. And then he's talking to his wife, and then he's talking to his wife. He listened to everything. Then he said, well, you know, Dwayne Schwartz, he can floss his teeth while driving the car. Oh, that's nice. Dwayne Schwartz. You know Dwayne? Yeah, well, he can floss his teeth while he's driving the car. Dwayne. Yeah, Dwayne. That guy. Yeah, he can floss his teeth while driving the car. Now, I'm trying to eat my bagel, and all I can see is these food fragments on the inside of the windshield. So be careful. The Wall Street Journal says is the good news is we're always connected to the office. The bad news is we're always connected to the office. Here's a doctor in Milwaukee. He says, I'm dying of easy accessibility. He says, telephones in our homes and offices, phones in our backyards and cars, beepers, fax machine, email, it's enough to give you a stroke. I swear, if Alexander Graham Bell walked in my office, I'd punch him in the nose. If he called, you can be sure that I'd put him on hold. Another thing is to just disconnect every once in a while. I think this is going to be a very common ethic that we're going to develop. Every once in a while, pretend you live in 1850 and say you can't do anything that you know, that wasn't invented by 1850. I mean, maybe do it one Tuesday night a month and just see what happens. I mean, see if you like it or not. There's an orthopedist in Manitoba. He says, I get home at 5:30 every night now. He heard me here in 95 at the physician conference. In 97, he told me the story. He says, I get home at 5:30 every night. It's hard, but I'm on call. I can't. But from 5:30 to 7:30 is our family time. We unplug the phones, help the kids with homework. We eat dinner together, plan family meetings, do things, projects around the house. And 8 months ago, he said, we got rid of the television set. His wife is just smiling from ear to ear. Then 2 years later, in 99, he came up to me and I said, hi, how you doing? Because I've gotten to know him now. And he says, great. He says, my son and I are just like this. And he just started sobbing and gave me a bear hug. Now, I haven't told anybody else to follow that formula. That's what they chose to do, but they disconnected. And it's worked for them. And it's been a glorious thing for them. So consider disconnecting. Do you know that record numbers of people are checking into hotels in their own hometown just to get away? At first, I was kind of mad at that. But then I thought, well, you know, it gets cold in Wisconsin in January, so kids can swim in the pool and you can order in a pizza and watch a family movie, and the kids will remember for 30 years. So make something good out of it. Consider disconnecting.
With some practical advice, that's Dr. Richard Swenson on today's Focus on the Family. And he has further prescriptions for stress relief coming up in just a moment. Let me say that his newest book is called In Search of Balance. And we have details about that and a CD of this program at focusonthefamily.com/radio, or in Canada, focusonthefamily.ca. Let's go ahead and get back to the good Dr. Swenson on today's Focus on the Family.
Every morning when you wake up, you have a certain quantum of emotional vitality. This is where the margin comes in. As you're going throughout the day, you discharge emotional energy. You're trying to solve problems and you're fighting with issues and so on. And then you're also receiving back. You listen to music and laugh and enjoy people that you really love a lot. And so there's a dynamic flux that happens all day long in discharging out, receiving back. The trouble is the conditions of marginless living cause us to drain faster than we fill. And a lot of people, their emotional chins are that high off the ground by coffee break time. So we have to figure out what can we do to fill our tank better than that. The first thing is social supports. Cultivate social supports. What that means, that's just kind of medical talk, I guess, for have good friends, nourished friendships. We know in medicine it works. It has been duplicated in many studies all across the United States. Probably the largest is the Human Population Laboratory in Alameda County, California. They started in the mid-60s. They take information on all kinds of people. They plug it in a supercomputer, push the button, out comes the report, good friends are good health. This is what God has encouraged us to do many, many years ago. If you are hurting somewhere in your spirit, somewhere in your soul, something you're going through something, if you go to another person and you tell them what you're going through, they don't have to know how to fix the problem. Just the fact you went there, opened your mouth, and talked about it is measurably therapeutic. You are healthier at the end of that. How about pets? Do you know that pet, astounding act of common grace, God decided to include pets? I don't know why. I mean, pets are measurably therapeutic. You go home and maybe you're single or you're recently bereaved or whatever it might be. You're lonely. You sit on the chair, that cat or dog jumps in your lap and gives affection, receives affection. They don't bite the way humans do. And it's measurably therapeutic. There's an insurance company to give you 8% off on your insurance policy if you're a pet owner. Life insurance. 57% of Americans that are pet owners, if they were stranded on a desert island, they'd choose to take their pet rather than another human being. Probably after the survivor program, it'd be up to 100% now, I think. Okay, reconciliation. So we're talking about restoring margin and emotional energy. Reconciliation. We know that people who reconcile, I mean, we all get into fights, right? Or if you don't get into fights, you at least harbor something here because there's a lot of jerks in the world. I mean, there's a lot of people out there that are doing things and you get upset at it and then you harbor that. We know that people who are able to get that out of there, somehow reconcile or somehow process that stuff and get it outside of themselves, they have better immune function. They have better cardiovascular parameters. In other words, they don't have as many heart attacks. We know that hostility is cardiotoxic. You die prematurely from hostility. They have less mental illness. They are happier. They have longer lasting relationships. There's all kinds of positives that come from reconciliation. And yet it's tough, isn't it? We know this in science, and God's been trying to teach us this for millennia, and it's tough. How about laughter? We know that people who laugh readily heal faster. We don't know all the physiology that's involved in that. We just know that people who laugh readily heal faster. Do you know what the peak age of laughter is? 4 years old. 4-year-olds laugh once every 4 minutes or 400 times a day. I don't know if the symmetry is God's or not. You know, 4-year-olds, four times, once every 4 minutes, 400 times a day. How about me? I'm 52. How many times do I laugh? 15. So you go from 400 to 15. What happened? We had kids that took care of 200 last, 300 last year. Follow a 4-year-old around and laugh every time they do. You will be healthier. There's one psychiatrist who recommends a half an hour of therapeutic laughter every day. If you laugh 15 times a day, you get up to 50, 75, 100, you will be healthier. No doubt about it. The best kind of laughter is where you laugh at yourself. You never run out of material. One guy, his house was blown down by Hurricane Andrew in South Florida, and he put a sign up in the front yard, open house. But you know what? He's going to heal faster than his neighbors will. Powerful stuff. But let's finish by talking about faith. In terms of emotional energy, we know now in medicine that faith is related to health. Dr. David Larson has done a lot of work on that. And there's a very clear linkage. When he was working with the National Institute of Health, all the psychiatrists he worked with treated faith as a negative mental health factor. In other words, you're a person of faith, you're mentally ill. So David Larson is a person of faith himself, so he had a research bias. He was a psychiatrist. He says, well, I'm going to do some studies because I don't think people of faith are mentally ill. So he was hoping he was going to prove it was neutral. Instead, the study started coming back. Everything was positive. It was associated with everything positive. He found two things neutral and nothing negative. And John Templeton, the billionaire guy, wrote him a very big check, says, start an institute, study this. And so David Larson has all kinds of studies and his Reader's Digest. He's got his curriculum in more than half of the medical schools in the United States, the link between faith and health. And that's another model perhaps we can use for the other kinds of issues between evolution and creation. Chuck Colson writes about Solzhenitsyn. After he became a Christian in the gulag, there was a physician who shared faith with Solzhenitsyn. And that night the physician was bludgeoned to death. He decided himself that he was going to turn toward God strongly with no compromise. And he told on the guards, they were stealing food from the prisoners. So this doctor told on the guards, and that night the guards beat him to death. But earlier that day, he had shared faith with Solzhenitsyn, and something stirred in Solzhenitsyn's heart, and he became a Christian and gave his life to God. But that didn't solve all his problems. He was still in the gulag. He was weak. He was emaciated. He was out working in the fields day in and day out. He was depressed. And finally, one day, he could not go any further. He put his shovel down. He goes to the side. He sits on a bench. He puts his head in his hands, and he's waiting. What he's waiting for is a guard to come, tell him to get back to work. When he say, no, I'm not going to get back to work, the guard would pick up his shovel and beat him to death. Solzhenitsyn knew exactly what he was doing here. But he felt, before a guard came, he felt a presence on the bench next to him. And Solzhenitsyn lifted his head and he looked into the face, utterly expressionless, wrinkled face of an old man. The old man didn't say anything. He just picked up a stick and he traced the sign of the cross in the dirt. And Solzhenitsyn looked at the man and he looked at the cross and he got up and he walked into the field and he picked up his shovel and he changed the world. And I don't know about you, but sometimes that's all that keeps me going. Tremendously powerful. Life is only vapor, then we're home. We know the cross. We know the power of the cross. We know the Christ of the cross. We have an inheritance that's incorruptible. This isn't a game. God's real, and He's there. Let's pray together. Father, I commit these people to Your keeping. It's easy to talk about this, but boy, couple days, Monday's going to be here, and the wheels are going to fall off the wagon, and then it's real. And Father, I pray that You'd encourage their hearts, lift their heads, give them the strength, Father, to carry on, help them to love when they're tempted to quit, help them to be interruptible, to have the margin to be interruptible. And Father, I just pray that You give them grace in their interaction with other people, and keep them, Father, until the day of Christ. And we pray this in Jesus' name.
Speak.